Hi, thank you for joining us for the Rethink podcast. My name is David, and I'm the editor of Think Magazine.
And I'm Nika, researcher and project manager at the University of Malta and a writer for Think Magazine.
Gareth Mitchell hosts the BBC's Digital Planet podcast. He lectures in broadcast and written journalism at Imperial College London. Before his interest in technology, Gareth used to participate in bell ringing. He is also a pilot and is a licensed amateur radio operator. Welcome, Gareth.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice to meet you, Gareth. So, first of all, bell ringing, that's a very, it's a very unique hobby to pick up. How did you get into bell ringing, if I may ask you?
Yeah, sure. I've never been asked about the bell ringing before, so I'm very glad to tell the story. And it's and this might be a specific thing to churches in the United Kingdom, but they have bell towers, which I know is not unique. But the bells in the bell towers are controlled. They're rung by lengths of rope that suspend right down into the bell ringing chamber below the bell tower. And which I guess in itself isn't unique, but the bell swings like a pendulum. And so what the bell ringer is doing is pulling on the rope, so the bell, which is in a sort of upright position with the donging thing facing upwards, when you pull on the rope, of course, then gravity does its thing and the bell swings down, and then the rope comes flying up, and then you pull back down again, and then you just ease the bell back as it swings in the opposite direction. But in a tower, you might have four bells, or six, or eight. The one I rang in had eight. And so the whole idea is that the bell ringers ring out these patterns on the bells, these permutations. So you start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then it might be 1, 3, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. And it's actually quite a mathematical thing. You ring in these permutations. And I did it as a teenager, probably to keep me off the local park benches causing trouble. I was living a wholesome existence up in the bell tower, keeping myself out of trouble, and ringing the peals of bells to welcome people to church.
You're a regular Quasimodo.
Yes, you could say that.
Let's jump right into the topic of today's discussion. We'll start by discussing the internet shutdowns in Kashmir. So basically, for our listeners who aren't familiar, Kashmir is currently undergoing massive internet shutdowns. And we're here with our guests to ask what impact this might have on democracy. So, Gareth, what are your thoughts about the internet shutdowns in Kashmir?
Well, it's all very political, as you implied in the question there, really. And this is Delhi trying to exert its control and succeeding, really, in exerting its control in many ways over the Muslims, or mainly Muslims, of Kashmir. And, of course, a very effective way of exerting that control is by depriving people in the region of their internet, their fixed internet, and indeed their mobile internet. And that has been going on and off, but mainly as in the internet being on and then off. So the shutdown has been on. In other words, the internet has been off pretty much for the last 18 months, maybe with a few times it comes back up again, or maybe it'll reappear, but just be very, very slow. And I suppose all of us around the world can identify with the inconvenience of an internet shutdown. I mean, my broadband went down here in London the other day for half an hour or so, and it disrupted a few meetings, and it was really annoying. But scale that up to just this ongoing, depriving people in Kashmir of their internet.
I was going to follow up and ask, do you think whether the internet is a fundamental human right at this point?
I think that is the case, because as an infrastructure, it gives access to human rights, the rights to healthcare, access to healthcare, for instance, the right to have access to employment. So, being able to access money, payments, shopping, the essentials of food, and indeed the social side, especially at a time like this where we need to be able to stay in touch with our loved ones and our families, then yes, the depriving people of connectivity by its nature deprives them of all kinds of things in their lives that they have a human right to access.
I guess this leads into another question. What is the, I mean, we're talking a lot about the internet, but what actually is the internet? I mean, it's sure, it's just a physical network of cables across the ocean bed, but I don't know, that feels like a simplistic answer. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. It's kind of like a brain in a way. And one way that I understand just how profound the internet is of course the design elements, the design philosophy at its heart, which is that it reconfigures itself. So, you know, for instance, if a ship, as these things often do, slices through one of the submarine cables, crucially connecting continents, then the packets of information that are trying to get from one place to the other will just reroute themselves around the internet. And so the whole point, you know, around the infrastructure as it was designed by the US military, by DARPANET in the 60s and 70s, was that it could survive an attack, it would just automatically reconfigure itself. And as an interesting, maybe troubling thought experiment, of course, imagine if there was, for some reason, humanity decided it didn't want the internet anymore, that all the problems that we've been discussing ended up outweighing the many benefits of the internet. And for some reason, humanity in the future said, this is now more harmful than good, we should close it down. And there was some kind of UN resolution to close down the internet. The thing is, we couldn't do it. We couldn't switch it off, even if we chose to. It is impossible to switch this thing off. So it has become a self-organizing entity in itself. There's something quite organic about that. There's something living about the internet, and it will outlive humanity. So you say it's an extension of humanity, and I agree with you, and it will outlive the humanity that created it.
Wow, that is both amazing and terrifying at the same time.
Sci-fi, yeah.
Yeah. You have mentioned culture in respect to what the internet is. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I suppose in the sense that it has... The internet, of course, reflects culture. It is a medium for transmitting culture, and that's a very basic argument in that, you know, you could say that Netflix happens because of the internet, and that's a transmission of culture. But of course, the internet has brought about with it cultures of its own, in terms of visual culture. For instance, and this is more World Wide Web than internet, if we're going to be pedantic, but when you think of the https://, you know, that's a kind of cultural artifact in itself, albeit a visual one or a piece of text. And I suppose what the internet does in a sense is it kind of makes us into cyborgs, in that certainly sitting on the internet, of course, is all the information that the World Wide Web helps us to locate through the internet. And of course, that is this enormous and ongoing and growing in real time extension of the human mind and human minds. And that's cultural in a sense as well. You know, so there are cultures and subcultures, whether they're artistic or musical or intellectual, that have only come about and can only exist because we have this thing called the internet. This big distributed machine called the internet creates a culture of its own, or at least of our own, as the humanity that created that internet.
Would you go so far as to say that some subcultures or some movements could not have come about if it wasn't for the internet?
I think that is what I would say, you know, that the internet enables, for instance, collaborative work in a way that you could argue that could take place without the internet, that those people collaborating online could be brought together into a physical space. But even if that were the case, the culture that emerges, the artistic or musical or intellectual or literary or dramatic outcomes would be different were they conducted in a purely physical space. And of course, the answer so far that I've just given hasn't even included the next level, which is when we go into artificial intelligence and the way that you have this synergy between the physical infrastructure and the algorithms that move culture on as well. But for instance, there are algorithms where you feed them a whole load of a certain kind of artist and they will create not just lyrics that might reflect what that artist might have written. You know, and we've seen this with Shakespeare, for instance, that you have kind of these virtual Shakespeare sonnets that have been created by AIs, but actual music. You know, you listen to a track and you think, I'm sure I never heard Frank Sinatra sing that, and that's because an AI created it. It still gives itself away a little bit. It doesn't quite authentically sound like Frank Sinatra, but it's not far off.
It's still incredibly impressive, huh? Yeah, it's incredibly impressive.
Absolutely. Impressive and scary, yeah.
It feels that it has become a part of us. Like you said, humanity is, for better or for worse, married to the internet.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we are embodied within it, and it is embodied within us, you know, especially when you think about implantable devices. So, you know, rather profoundly, if you think about this transition that I've certainly seen in my lifetime, where nothing was connected before, and then, of course, our desktop PCs became connected, then through Wi-Fi, our laptops and mobile devices became connected, and now our bodies, and indeed our brains, are becoming connected through implantable technology. You know, even the fact that you wear a fitness tracker, for instance, is a form of the fusion of the body with the machine. So when you think of the you know, the images and the sounds and maybe the art or the videos or installations that can be created and are being created from all this pooled data of conversations and resemblances and, as I've mentioned, body data and so on, that's just a huge fusion of everything that is us that can be manipulated, repurposed, you know, just synthesized into who knows what.
Earlier, you mentioned about implants. Would you, let's say there's the opportunity to install like a chip into your, I don't know, into part of your body, into your brain, for instance, and instead of having to access the internet through your cell phone, you'd be able to do it without a cell phone. Would it be something that you or Nika would do? Is it something you think most people would get behind it?
This is going to be an odd answer, actually. I am sitting here hesitating. I kind of want to say yes, but something in me is hesitating. And I think it's partly I just hate injections. I don't have any tattoos. I think it's just the idea that somebody's going to put a needle or something somewhere near me to put the implant in, that it might hurt me a little bit. And so it's odd that my initial reaction is more about just not fancying the thought of that than maybe the bigger and wider and more important and profound and fundamental question about consensually putting something into my body that effectively makes me into part of the network, into the internet of bodies. So as long as it doesn't hurt, I'm not too, I suppose that I just have to, I'm thinking on my feet here a little bit. I think I would just have to be sure that the benefits I receive from that would outweigh the downsides. And actually, as I age, I suspect that equation will go more in the favor of the machines. So at the moment, luckily, you can see I have to wear glasses, but that's about the only body enhancement I need to get through my life. But of course, all of us face the prospect of losing mobility or sight or hearing or indeed cognitive function and memory and what have you. And I suspect that if an implanted device allowed me to function at a higher level as I age than would be the case without that implant, then I would say, yeah, just stick it in. Even if it hurts, let's just put this thing in because it will make my life better.
But Nika, what about you? Would you invest in a, you know, cyborg enhancement?
The scientist in me is saying that we are so far away from understanding the implications of this kind of technology. And I think we're still in the very, very early stages of understanding the effects of social media. And our brains have not adapted to this technological age. And we're so far, far away from reaching a point where our brains can actually function well in the society that we've created with this technology. So I would say jumping into something like this seems a bit too risky.
I mean that's a fair enough as an answer. I think I'd go for it, honestly. I mean, I can't wait to be able to process more information faster and, you know, just be connected. Just be a better version of myself through technology.
But we're already suffering from information overload on a daily basis.
Ah, but you at least now you need to process it.
Oh.
Yeah. So the implant would filter it out into everything we need to live our lives. But then,
exactly.
But then who controls the filter? And yeah, all that stuff.
Well, I mean, but that does lead us very neatly into the next question. Earlier you mentioned the actual infrastructure of the internet, that there's these mobile phone towers. But this begs the question, who actually owns the internet? Is it the person who owns the phone towers? Is it according to the region where it is? Who owns it?
And maybe what your question is searching for is more about almost what is the moral ownership of the internet? And if we extend the definition of the internet beyond the infrastructure and into the content that is on it, then you get into some very deep questions about the ownership of data. You know, for instance, coming back to body data, of which, of course, there are now exabytes of that stuff on the internet, pools from fitness trackers and heart monitors and goodness knows what around the world. That, you know, that data, if we come down to the data question, that is really interesting and problematic, because I might argue that the data coming from my fitness tracker is mine, because it's my body data, you know, my heart. What could be more, what could you own more than your own heartbeat, for instance? So the physical infrastructure of the internet, we can probably, in a fairly straightforward way, if we had the scale to do it, pin that down to ownership, you know, by certain entities. The data sitting on the internet, that's a whole other thing. In some cases, of course, the government can physically own the internet in countries where, and I think Iran might be an example, where the state runs the internet service providers. The state can turn around and say, well, actually, that building with that, all that equipment in, that is, you know, we put that fiber in, so it is ours to shut down if we want to. For people who think, well, surely it can't be that big a deal if you shut down the internet, but the sum total of all the internet shutdowns in the world, according to some figures from a VPN provider, for 2019 were $8 billion. And you'd wonder why any state would willingly forfeit economic wealth, basically, and yet there are plenty of states who are quite happy to take the economic hit in return for having control over their people.
But also that economic revenue, I mean, I imagine that's coming largely from North America and the West, populations that are rich enough to consume at a significant scale.
Well, I mean, that would be the case, but of course we're not seeing the shutdowns in places like where you have the liberal democracy. So, you know, you don't have internet shutdowns, as far as I'm aware, in places like the United States or Sweden or Italy or, you know, Malta or the UK or wherever it might be. You know, so given that many of these internet shutdowns tend to be in lower or middle income countries, that $8 billion figure is all the more shocking, because that's $8 billion of economic losses, borne largely by the people of lower to middle income countries.
So I'm very curious now, because you've got me thinking about the negative impacts of these shutdowns. One, I haven't really seen in the news anything about Kashmir, and I understand that we're sort of preoccupied with COVID, but I also can recall a very positive aspect of the internet in which there was, I believe, a woman in Sudan, I'm not sure which part, maybe South Sudan, who was going to be hung for being Christian. And forgive me if I'm getting my information wrong, but the point I want to make is that it was the intervention of sort of the international crowd over the internet that has stopped this from happening, because this event was getting widespread attention. And now I'm thinking, well, if we were to react to this shutdown in Kashmir, would there then be pressure on the government? And why hasn't that been happening, especially if we're framing internet as a human right?
And that's exactly why governments, many governments, are shutting the internet down, because we don't hear from them. Because by definition, they block information. That's, for many of these governments, the whole point of having the shutdown, to suppress information coming out of those parts of the world. You know, we've seen it in the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, internet shutdowns in that region. So, you know, by their nature, they are about blocking information. And that's why, for instance, the Kashmir Kashmir shutdown, affecting millions of people, depriving millions of people of their livelihoods, you know, should be big international news stories. Even in the time of COVID, it should at least be getting somewhere onto the news agenda. But this is a sign that internet shutdowns actually do what they're meant to do, which is to block information so that people are not sufficiently discussing state control and state coercion of often vulnerable people. A great question, though. Why don't we hear about these shutdowns? Well, that's really the point of the shutdown, so that we don't know about them and they don't get the coverage that they should get.
I mean, they are terrifyingly effective, the internet shutdowns, I would say, ruthlessly effectively. However, what concerns me, you would have people who could argue, they'd say, but what is NetBlock's agenda then? Like, how can you be sure that the data they are providing is genuine? It's like they only trust information that is coherent with their worldviews.
Yeah.
And I find this to be quite worrying. And I'm not sure if we, humanity as a species, can actually get out of it.
Well, it raises a huge issue. One, I suppose, answer or solution to that issue is about data and open data. But of course, I suppose what you're referring to is this deeper and darker problem of the conspiracy theorists. And we see them both around internet shutdowns, but I suppose even more worryingly around the anti-vax movement and with COVID and with mis and disinformation around election campaigns. I suppose it's a whole other thing. And having spoken so much about the internet as a human need, as an amazing thing that humanity has created, and therefore, you know, no element of humanity should deny another element of humanity, its brothers and sisters of the internet. The darker side of it, the problematic side, is around the mis and disinformation that on one level just means that you might have a few rather badly informed people who can frankly just be a bit annoying when they pop up on the social media, but at a much more, we all know who they are, at a profound and more troubling level, of course, we're seeing that flows of mis and disinformation are disrupting the very machinery of democracy and affecting the outcome of elections and responses to climate change and the COVID. And that, of course, is extremely serious and worrying.
But I wouldn't just say it's a problem with election campaigns. I feel it affects the whole political theater in the sense that each state would be spinning its own narrative. So, for instance, in the US, I mean, we have, I'm sure our viewers have heard of the Great Firewall or the Splinternet, rather, where you have an entire section of the internet is like shut off for people in mainland China, and then you have sections of internet that are shut off for people in the US. So it's like we have two separate internets. I mean, it's very easy to read between the lines, I would say, where, for instance, you have the US pushing for US-based applications and websites. For instance, Trump, when he wanted TikTok to be sold from its Chinese owners.
Yeah, I suppose it's just that for most of the internet history that we've lived through, we've been able to say it's this one thing, it's this one piece of critical infrastructure that is delightfully, I suppose, free or liberated from geopolitics. But now, of course, the internet is highly geopoliticized, as indeed we've seen with that spat with Donald Trump and TikTok and China. The idea that the internet can be politicized and that people's access to the networks and certain kind of data are at the whim of some very, shall we say, troublesome political vested interests.
My next question would be, whether democracy and the internet should be so integrated. Personally, I have a very unpopular opinion in the sense that I don't think democracy is all it's cracked up to be, personally. And I'm sure people will disagree with me, and they have every right to. But do you think that democracy and the internet should be integrated?
It's for me, it's not so much about whether it's about democracy and the internet. I suppose it is, what relates to democracy is regulation. And of course, that's something that democracies bring about. You know, we vote for our legislators who then pass all kinds of environmental regulations, or in this case, regulations, and increasingly, especially across Europe, as we know, through things like GDPR, where there has been a political consensus that regulation is needed. And, you know, people can take their own view as to how healthy data protection legislation agreed at a European level is. But then I suppose that what's really interesting about your question is about democracy. You know, whether some of us feel that we've lost faith in democracy, and therefore that would be an argument for completely decoupling the states or legislators from the workings of the internet. But what that comes down to is how will our will be reflected as the information society continues to spread?
The question then comes to whether anyone is actually listening. I mean, what's the point of having everyone state their opinion and then the decisions that are taken are done so irrespective of what people actually feel?
But then I suppose one hopes or one assumes that we find as a society a means of expressing the will of the people, and in many places that is through democratic representation. So, those who do not listen to the expressed will of the people, whether on the social media or at the ballot box, eventually find themselves out of power by, for instance, exposing corruption, exposing wrongdoing to make us better able as citizens to hold our democratically elected representatives to account.
Any final comments or thoughts before we close?
My final thoughts, I thoroughly enjoyed that, and it was a really good opportunity to think quite seriously about who we are as people. You know, what do we want as people? And humanity developed the internet, so now what can it continue to deliver, you know, back to us? So, you know, it's been really, really fascinating. So I think my closing thought is that all of us, maybe it is our civic duty for all of us in society to have these discussions, to think carefully about the information networks and about the way that we're represented and the way that our rights are determined and protected. So conversations like this are important, because if we don't have them, it might be that corporations or states will just do their own things and not necessarily in our interest. So what we're talking about today matters.
Absolutely. This was fascinating, and you brought up some very interesting points and food for thought. So thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to hear the full version of this podcast, feel free to visit um.edu.mt/think.